Welcome to the Navit Gaming Podcast, where it is our mission to explore the business and future of video games. We bring together the industry's brightest builders, investors, and thinkers to keep a pulse on current events, dissect emerging trends in games, share lessons learned, and have a great time. This podcast is also part of Navit's growing ecosystem, which ranges from free and premium research to consulting and advisory services. For more information, visit www.navic.co. This episode is brought to you by Rally Here, the proven gaming backend platform and service made specifically for cross-platform live service games. Providing cutting-edge tooling for matchmaking, cross-platform accounts, server optimization, live ops management, player progression, and community engagement, Rally Here is the one-stop shop to streamline your development processes, increase speed to market, and optimize your post-launch live services. Rally Here powers games that have been played by over 200 million gamers worldwide across PC, console, and mobile, including Smite, Paladins, Rogue Company, and many others. Rally Here's founders were also among the first to embrace cross-platform free-to-play games, meaning the Rally Here solution incorporates over a decade of hard-won experience and learnings in live service games. Rally Here's partnership approach to customer relationships makes them a trusted and experienced co-pilot to help your team as you develop and operate your live service games. Do you want to know how Rally Here can help you with your live service game? If so, simply head over to rallyhere.gg to learn more and schedule a demo. Again, that is rallyhere.gg. So with that, let's jump into the episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Navic Roundtable. I'm your host, Devin Becker. And of course, two wonderful guests who you've seen a lot on this podcast, Aaron and Dave. We have a little bit of an announcement here from Aaron about the podcast.
Yeah, jumping right into it. This is the final roundtable episode of the Navic Gaming Podcast, at least for now. It's bittersweet to share in part because this segment is what started it all, right? This today is our 138th roundtable episode, I believe. And the first one we published, which was our first episode ever, was on May 21st, 2021. So we've been going strong with these roundtables for nearly 3 years now. And by the way, guys, quick trivia. Do you remember what the first roundtable episode was about? I don't even, or if you weren't even paying attention then, I'm just curious, like, when did you start paying attention? It's interesting.
I probably started listening, oh, wow, year and a half or 2 years ago. So it wasn't right from the very beginning. I caught on later on.
Still an OG.
Yeah. Still early days. Yeah, I know I was a big fan, which is what pushed me to reach out to see if I could hop on. And for me, this is actually 1 year as of this month. So it's been a lot of fun.
Congrats. And I'm sorry at the same time, but it's been a great year with you, Dave. Anyways, Devin, do you remember?
I don't remember what the topics were. There was a lot of just, I think, general news stuff at the time. I actually, my involvement throughout all the Navic stuff I've been doing since 2021 was from actually the Crypto Corner, but it's still like the podcast and stuff in general got me to reach out to you guys, which is why I always encourage everyone to reach out when there's anything you to contact Navic about, because like it started a lot of collaborations we've had together since. And I think having an outreach like this is fantastic. And I'm glad there's a lot of other ones still going on, part of which I'll still be involved with. So I think plenty to go, but 138 episodes and a good long time. I think people got their money's worth on this one, I hope.
I hope so. But anyways, that first episode, it was about AppLovin's IPO and spending a lot of time digging into the Apple versus Epic case where they like unveiled a bunch of information.
Hasn't left yet.
Yeah, it's the topic that is still giving. Even today, these topics are coming full circle still. Circles.
At least
round
the Microsoft acquisition finally finished. That was the one. I wasn't sure if we were going to make it to the end of the roundtable for that one.
Yeah, we got that one under our belt. But anyways, we've had a great run, and really I just have so many people to thank for it. First of all, Nico, who's now at Bitcraft, he helped kickstart the whole podcast. He did the initial planning, the hosting, the editing, the thumbnailing, pretty much everything on day one, which was incredible. And we have a team for all of those parts now, but major props to Nico for being a great bootstrapping partner 3 years ago. And then plus, of course, Maria and now Devin as hosts these past couple of years, they've been amazing to work with too. And obviously we have so many amazing panelists from over the past 3 years, more than I could name right now. But sincerely to all of you who are tuning in, thank you to all of you for making this segment possible over the years. You taught me a lot, and I know you taught thousands of other people a tremendous amount about our ever-evolving industry too. So why are we making this change? In short, our interviews generally perform better, and managing a big crew of rotating panelists has more logistical challenges than it may seem. We're really just going to refocus and double down on what our listeners are engaging in the most right now. But that said, we're still going to experiment with new segments. I'm still going to bring a bunch of these panelists back at times, and you'll probably see several emerge elsewhere in Navik's ecosystem, like as writers for Navik Digest, maybe even consultants with us. Even Devin here today, he just published his first interview with us a couple of weeks ago, so make sure to check that out if you haven't already. That was a great conversation. But anyway, we'll continue to learn and adapt, and we'd love your feedback. So really, my one request from the grand finale of these roundtables is just for your feedback. If you have suggestions or ideas for new segments that you'd like to see us try on the podcast, let us know. Send us a note to podcast@navik.co, or you can just send me a message on LinkedIn, or whatever is easier. Or hey, even if you just want to shoot a note of appreciation that I can pass along to the team, that'd be cool too. So it would just be great to hear your thoughts. But all that said, we're still going strong, still thinking big. Can't wait to serve you for many years to come in whatever forms that may take. And thanks as always for tuning in. But with that, I'll hand it back over to Devin to kickstart the actual conversation and discussion for today.
I think, like I said, the conversation continues in the digest and the other interviews, and who knows what else in the future, because we had no idea. Certainly this would be 138 episodes of this idea when it started back in 2021. So that being said, though, the other elephant in the room that I think we're all still recovering from at this point, GDC. Both of you were there. I was there as well. Who wants to just share their initial thoughts first? Dave, I think you're ready to go with some exciting anecdotes.
Hopefully they're exciting. We'll see. Yeah, no, I very much enjoyed the show. I was there Wednesday through Friday, so the main portion. I wasn't there for any of the earlier portions. I spent my time certainly walking a lot. I think my record was over 17,000 steps. That was Thursday, so a lot of visiting of the various halls and all of the hotels around, because it seemed even if you have a GDC pass, you're going to be spending a lot of time in the hotels rather than inside the halls themselves. One of the things that was really interesting for me was the large number of brand new game companies that were there promoting themselves and looking for, you know, funding if they can, helping get the word out about, you know, who they are, what types of games they're doing. I think the last time I saw this number of new companies coming out and really pushing themselves was probably back when crypto gaming really started to kick off. But I do want to point out that I think, in my own opinion, these are actually companies this time around are filled with people that have made games before. They know how to make games. And that's their primary focus, is just trying to create fantastic games rather than potentially taking advantage of a trend at a particular time. I saw some really fantastic stuff from people that are fairly new to the industry through to people that have been in the industry for decades. I had an opportunity, for example, to see Bill Roper's new game from Legacy. So Bill Roper, of course, being old school Blizzard, and has done a number of companies since then, but he was out there showing off his game just as much as everybody else was, looking to see what he can do with in terms of funding and getting excitement built around what he's trying to do in his company. There were certainly a large number of job seekers there. The recruiters were certainly busy, and to be expected with the amount of layoffs that have happened in the last little while. But one of the things I found really good about being at GDC was a very supportive atmosphere. People that had jobs were taking people that were looking for jobs out for lunch. There was a lot of introductions happening of, hey, you should talk to this person because I think they're looking for something, or they're looking for people to help support their game. And I would say it certainly had a high hug factor. there was a lot of really good supporting feelings around the show. And I think that really does say something for our industry, where there certainly are some challenges inside of our industry, but there are also some really good people inside looking to help. I didn't find one really big theme for the show. AI was certainly there. There were a number of companies that were showing off tools to try and help production development faster. There's been a bit of a pickup on the Web3 side of things because Bitcoin valuation's going up. But there wasn't one overarching dominant theme I found throughout the show, except for maybe one theme, and that was austerity. There was only one booth that I would say that was there, of that E3 level of booth where it's big booth, you know, obviously a big spend, and that was Epic. And considering Epic makes Epic money these days, I'm sure they can afford to put that booth in there without much of a problem. Tencent was close. They spent certainly some on their booths, but on the most part, it definitely showed that companies were looking to keep their costs down. NetEase, for example, I don't think they have much in the way of games to show right now, but they just had a small booth and their focus was entirely on recruiting, looking on how they can build up their staff. It was interesting, E3 or GDC wasn't as populated as it has been in the past, but I think there certainly was a little bit of uptick in some ways. But yeah, a lot of walking. How about you guys? What did you guys see?
A lot of walking, a lot of overcrowded hotel lobbies. It was my first GDC, and so I was just figuring out how the game is played, and I realized the game is basically just played in hotel lobbies, which, cool, very overpacked hotel lobbies, and then you got to walk elsewhere anyways, have walking meetings or whatever, which is fine, but really, I mean, beyond that, it was just great to see people. Saw probably a dozen or so Novik people who are our podcast friends, our writing friends, consulting friends, and was great to see them around the event, to bring them together for a lunch that we had, which was nice to meet so many people in person for the first time. But even beyond that, just amazing to meet so many people in person for the first time in many cases that we've been interfacing with for quite a while now. And then, of course, meeting new people as well. So, yeah, at least for me, it was pretty productive, but tiring. What I've noticed, and there's no shortage of these LinkedIn posts of like, here's what I noticed at GDC. And I'm just like, ugh, at this point, please stop writing those. I'm so tired of them. But what I've noticed is just that everyone's perception is different because of the different bubbles or the different areas that people are focused on. And so I think it really, there is a lot going on that feels different depending on where you are. But from my point of view, I definitely did sense a tension where, like, on one side, like, it's just the fallout from this age of efficiency that we're in, where obviously the past couple of years have been difficult for layoffs. Dave talked about that well. And you could definitely feel that around the event where people are trying to figure out what's next. And then on the other side, compared to events a year ago, even a year ago, there it was a lot about like, oh, we're in a recession, prepare for a recession, like everything is going down. And today there still is some of that hardship, but there are like more zones of optimism. And there isn't necessarily like a new blue ocean, right, that stacks on top of the industry to expand the industry in a big way. But there are like these areas of innovation, and AI is the big one. UGC is the other big buzzword. Really, those two areas I've noticed are like the biggest convergence trends that people are excited about. Web3 would be like the third one. And in those zones, people are excited. They're building cool new things, but there still is that tension there of these technologies make the industry more efficient. They democratize game development. It's cool, but it doesn't necessarily solve some of the other issues that other people have been. So anyways, I come out of it feeling excited in some ways, but also feeling a bit stressed or bad for a bunch of other people as well. And it'll be interesting to see over the next year or two how the tone shifts at these events and what are the things people are excited about, or whether this overhang that we feel, whether that's going to continue to linger for longer than we would hope and expect.
I think on the plus side is we're looking at all these people currently out of work or trying to start new studios or things like that. But this is an industry that does, I think, value experience. we always talk about formerly from this company, formerly from that company, it like matters, right? It's an industry where it's hard to start without like actually getting a bunch of experience, the classic like starting out as a QA tester and working your way up, things like that. Like experience, especially as like an old school game developer in this industry, I think is valuable to like a lot of people that value that. And so I think a lot of these people that have that maybe had been in it for a while and then are now essentially getting a little bit of a break, maybe just to recollect, to rethink things. But I don't doubt that if they want to, they will land on their feet because that experience is valuable. Because if you're going to be hiring again and you're trying to build up a team, who are you going to look to pick up? All these people that you know do good work. I remember like throughout the whole Web3 thing, like how often it was like people with actual game development experience was like the most exciting thing ever. And it's like, hey, if Web3 comes back, then guess who needs jobs? So it seems one of these things where I obviously am not in the position, so it's a little bit different for me, but I do see that this is an industry where there could be potentially silver linings as long as we don't have our Atari moment. Like this is still something that will turn around and it may just mean things are shifted around, but this is not the first time in the game industry that like we've had to go through these ups and downs. And I think it's great that GDC is like that. A lot of these people have been going for a long time. I talked to someone who'd been to like, it was like somewhere close to 20 of them that he'd been to. And it's just, there's a lot of old school people and there's a lot of postmortems and looking backwards and looking forwards. And I think that's why it's such a cool event for that sort of thing. Even if it's a little bit of a job fair at times, as we joke being the floor, but that's actually great because a lot of these people know each other. It is an industry where a lot of people know each other. And I think that taking each other out to lunch and all that, that's great to hear. That sort of thing still happens. I was personally a bit more in the Web3 circle, so I was maybe a little insulated from that to some extent. But the funny thing is, we get to see those ups and downs like every 6 months in Web3, where the sky is falling and then everything's going to be great and then the sky is falling again. So I feel like I see that just constantly. But the funny thing is, in a similar way, the one thing I notice is I can count on seeing the same people every year still excited about it, still building, still doing the cool things, still talking about like, oh, have you seen this? This is going on. I have this cool tech over here. Like, everyone's still excited about it, even with those ups and downs. And I think that as a microcosm is interesting to see as its own like mini game industry. And I find like the hotel lobby thing you put in, I found kind of funny because in between meetings, I was like, why go do whatever? I just will go to the hotel lobby and sit there and I will run into five people between like in a half an hour between a meeting that I know or want to know. Like it's, and you don't have to go do anything. You just sit in the lobby. And I think that's a really cool part about GDC is that the event's cool and everything, but like the stuff going on around it, because everyone's doing stuff, having events, parties, get-togethers, lunches, brunches, breakfasts. Like it's a really lively event in that sense. And I think it's really cool. I've gone the last few years, especially around the Web3, and that scene just never seems to die out despite everyone saying, oh, it's going to be dead this year. And it's never dead. It seems like, even if it's just in hotel lobbies, it never seems to go away. And I think that as a theme takeaway for me, for GDC, regardless of what seems to be going on in the macro, I think it's heartening. I think it's great. Like Dave said, the big hug factor. So I think I'm looking forward to when we're like, I remember that when there was like all those things going on and like, everyone's got too many jobs going here. And hopefully a year or less. But I do think it was interesting to see Web3 like on a, hey, there's money to be made again, come back, which is kind of the Western style of things. It doesn't surprise me, but it does seem, obviously it's scaled down to a smaller set of participants that are like, hey, we're the ones who are kind of survivors from the first waves. And maybe we know what we're doing now. I'm looking forward to that. Like a lot of that stuff, along with the new studios you mentioned, like down the road, gelling into something that maybe it's not like we get an immediate thing going on. But that being said, there still was a ton of announcements at GDC. You can't go to GDC without tons of things happening. And there was a couple standout ones. You guys want to cover those?
Yeah. So a bunch happened. We don't have to talk about these a ton, but for one, probably like the big deal that broke was Sensor Tower acquiring Datadot AI, which surprises a lot of people because Datadot AI is the business that had raised much more money and presumably was the larger business. And so I'm not going to speculate on what exactly happened within Datadot AI and Sensor Tower to make this deal happen. And of course, Datadot AI has been our data partner for quite a while now. They've been great to work with. But yeah, this is going to have some ripple effects across the industry when two leading platform companies combine. And in one sense, it potentially brings the best of two worlds together into more robust feature sets, bringing great talent together, et cetera. And I imagine that in some sense, this combined entity will create features that serve the games industry better over time. But on the other hand, it's just tough when things like this happen. I think it was reported, and I don't know how true this is, but that already with Data.ai, we've seen about half of the company be laid off, which is extremely difficult to go through. And so I hope everyone on that team is able to find their footing, and we'll, of course, learn more about where this is all going to go over time. So we'll probably, we might talk about it later, do some interview and about this deal at some point in the future. But that was really the big news to break. And beyond that, just to list off a few more news items that happened, and then we can take this in whatever order. But another lawsuit against Apple dropped, this time from the U.S. government, the DOJ, about some of their practices. The Epic Games Store announced that it'll be officially launching on mobile by the end of this year. We got some Unreal Engine updates from Epic too. So Epic was busy with the announcements. There's probably more we could talk about too, but I'll just pause there. Is there any direction you guys want to take with any of this?
I think one thing actually I didn't mention around GDC that should have, that's related to the Unreal Engine side of things, is Godot had a nice size platform or a nice size booth at the show. So I think with Unity's recent missteps in terms of their pricing and so forth, the other engines have tried to step up to see what they can do to take some of that. Unreal, I think, really does push the high end. And I have seen a number of demos where people are using the latest and greatest, and they just look good right out of the box without a lot of effort. And Godot on the other side was then working as best as they could to take maybe some of those, the games that needed something a little less powerful than the Unreal Engine. And this certainly was the show for them, because it was probably that perfect moment for them where Unity was in not the good graces of developers' eyes. Number one. Number two, there's a whole bunch of new companies started up, so they didn't have legacy issues in terms of what engines to support. There's a lot of different types of games being experimented with now on the indie side, but that's a little tangent off.
You know who might have been actually, I'm thinking, is hanging out over at Godot's booth is the Helldiver 2 developers, Arrowhead, because they just finished that game on a totally discontinued engine. I got to imagine they're shocked a little bit. Maybe over at Epic's booth too, but I just think it's cutting timing for them.
Yeah, for me, with the Epic stuff. One, with the Unreal related announcements, Unreal is always steadily improving and, you know, working to keep its state of the art tier in the industry. But the stuff that was more interesting to me, honestly, was more around the UEFN. So for example, like we saw a few months ago how they created Lego Fortnite, how they had their racing game, and now basically they're opening up UGC functionalities around those types of those games and then the tooling around them, which is exciting. It just, we continue to see like the broadening of the creative surface area that's possible and the types of games that are possible to build on UEFN. And that's a big deal. But yeah, even beyond that, what's next for UEFN and some of what they announced, like more camera and control systems so that you can have different vantage points of looking at a map. That unlocks the creative surface area quite a bit. There's going to be more, they're working to create more personalized rows like in the Discover tab of UEFN, which is helpful for games teams making games and helping get discovered and targeted by the gamers that actually would be more interested in those types of games. And that makes a big deal. Continuing to improve the sandbox gameplay, like in-game item building, just like a bunch of like these little tactical things that like really do add up. And I know recently they've added more like save features so that you can go back and resume sessions, and like all of these like add up over time. But it's like, it's good to see the pace of improvement, and that like this is not going to like within a year be like a switch flipping and suddenly like everything is viable at once, but it'll be you know, like I've talked about in some episodes, like how with Roblox, it really has just been like a snowball rolling down a mountain in terms of its capability, its network, just slowly building and compounding steadily over time. I think we'll see something pretty similar with UEFN, and the announcements from this event can confirm that. And I think that's great. And then with the Epic Games Store launching on mobile, I'm glad that Epic has this developer-friendly ethos and that they're willing to, you know, push for more competition, even at the expense of their own business. And in a lot of ways, it's been helpful for the industry, and I think will continue to be. With this launch, I don't know how successful a new app store will be for third-party game publishers. Like, just breaking the network effects and convincing users to use alternative app stores for games they could get easily, that's going to be really hard, potentially too hard, and not really be worth it unless you have another reason to be there. And Epic's case, there is another reason to be there, which is Fortnite and increasingly UEFN. And so really, I view the Epic Game Store more as a Trojan horse for bringing Fortnite back and UEFN to mobile for the first time, which is really exciting, and seeing how UEFN will work on mobile and what kinds of experiences people will build more for mobile audiences or just cross-platform audiences. So yeah, we'll see what that turns into, but they're going to be launching by the end of the year, and so we should hopefully learn much more in the next few months of what that will look like.
It definitely seems a little risky trying to put that much effort into a store that might not be the best fit. I'm really curious how that'll go, because like, same thing if you imagined Steam just coming to mobile. It works on Steam Deck because that's a little PC in your hand, and it's like, it's just an extension essentially of your computer and your account. It is going to be a little strange in that I don't think there's like a lot of mobile games on Epic Store or mobile like style games. And you see the sort of fight, I think, on Steam over free-to-play and mobile style games when they get ported, and that sort of like backlash. Whereas maybe Epic has a little bit more of a clean slate there because they don't have that legacy of gamers that Steam does. And they also have that like big Fortnite crowd that's maybe a younger audience that's not as entrenched in that battle and maybe a lot happier. I mean, Fortnite is a free-to-play game. So it'll be interesting to see if that audience shakes out, right? Because that's a hard thing, to do, not just on top of launching a new store, but also one that isn't technically a mobile-first store. But it will be really interesting, especially, I guess, for Web3, that could be a big deal too, because them being a Web3-friendly store on the PC, I'm willing to even adjust policies to help keep like things working well for them. Like, that could be a pretty interesting bridge over to mobile now, where it actually lands with Apple's policies and everything else. We'll see how all that shakes out, but it is very interesting. And I do wonder, in terms of the demographic, and like for ratings on games and things like that they have to deal with, are different, right? Different mentality, whereas like Epic's a bit more like Google Play and Apple is a bit closer to Nintendo. So it'll be a really interesting fit there. I could totally see it on Android, but iOS will be very interesting, especially given the sort of constant battling between those two. But I, like you said, if it's coming by the end of the year, I'm excited for that. UEFN still has a kind of a ways to go technologically, but it's doing it very quickly compared to Roblox, which took, I think, at least a decade to really get rolling. I don't think it's going to take that long for UEFN. They obviously have the player base, the will from all the developers, things like that. So that will be a very interesting platform for mobile, but I'm curious how well that will run from a hardware standpoint, as Unreal is not necessarily like the lightest engine to run on mobile. But I do imagine they try and continue to optimize at least Fortnite for it, which is what UEFN is basically using as its platform. So I'm pretty excited for it, honestly. As cool as Roblox is from a technology standpoint, I probably won't be playing it anytime soon just because it's not really my scene, as they say. So it'd be cool to have a little bit of a better one there, I think.
And the one thing I'd ask for out of the Sensor Tower data.ai merger is if they could somehow figure out how to track ad revenue. It is the biggest thing missing from the business intelligence side of things from mobile. There's so many games out there that get 80% of their revenue from ads, 20% from IAP, but there's not a really good understanding of what that looks across the industry.
I expect it'll become more important too. I do expect that ads will creep into more IAP style ones. And you're right, that's like a big need when you're trying to understand like the actual financial revenue system setup of a company. Otherwise, just guessing.
And then the last big news item that I mentioned is the new Apple court case, this time brought by the U.S. government. And it's interesting. It wouldn't be a Navic Gaming podcast episode without being able to talk about regulatory issues at Apple, right? Ending on a bang here. But anyways, what's interesting about this is that it actually has nothing to do with the App Store. And most of the grievances in the past have stemmed around people's unhappiness with App Store policies. Obviously, unhappiness around the 30% cut. But then, of course, of all of just the rules around what's allowed, like what links you're allowed to share, etc. And so what this case is about is several things. But to summarize it, it's really about how it's going against Apple and how they are limiting the potential for super apps, which are like apps, basically like apps within apps where you can get all sorts of different functionalities. Cloud streaming gaming apps, like a Xbox Game Pass xCloud type of app, how like some issues around messaging, and this is like ridiculous, but people are upset about the green and blue bubbles and how Apple like makes their own messaging look differently from others. Some pieces of this case honestly are ridiculous, but they're throwing a lot out there maybe to see what will stick. Similarly, like interoperability with like smartwatches. And so Apple's premise, its entire existence has been about like integration, like vertical integration initially, like software and hardware just on its computers. And increasingly like that integration across its hardware and how its software and its own hardware is like a competitive advantage. But people are increasingly saying that as Apple has become larger, it's become more anti-competitive for them to just prioritize making things work on their own hardware. And then lastly, around digital wallets, and I think they're like NFC tech, where for like Apple Wallet, you can make payments a certain way that doesn't interface well with like other types of phones and the wallets that they have. It's interesting. A lot of this is more about like it's attacking what has differentiated Apple's business over a long period of time, which is that integration of hardware and software that makes it special and what makes like Apple unique compared to these other hardware manufacturers and device makers. And I was reading an article in Stratechery about this, and the author, Ben Thompson, I think he made an interesting point in just saying that there's so much like angst against Apple right now. And that really, again, this has nothing to do with the App Store, but their fatal flaw was fighting so hard on policies in the past that they could have just bent the knee a little too and changed and made people happier. And then probably the anger would have gone away and they wouldn't be dealing with lawsuits like this today that are just attacking all of the other parts of their business and trying to dismantle what makes Apple unique and special. And so where this goes, first of all, it's going to take years to play out, right? It's going to have to go through court. It'll go through appeals. Then I don't know. I don't know the legal system well enough to know like how many tiers and steps this will go through, but a lot over many years. But what I will say is I do think some of this is a little ridiculous, but some of it, I do think there's a real case, like with gaming, cloud gaming apps that can be allowed. There really is no problem in letting xCloud be accessible on iPhones, right? So I think this case will be hit and miss, probably lead to some positive change, but it'll just take forever to play out in consumer-friendly ways. So anyways, that was a lot, but that's my quick take on the latest in this never-ending saga.
Just out of curiosity, did you see some of the DOJ stuff being brought up in relationship to some of the things they've gone through in Europe? So Europe has gone through a lot of those things where Europe now allows things for cloud gaming, alternative payment plans, a lot of the things I think that are starting to come up through lawsuits more in North America versus what has gone on in Europe. Do you see that more of just catching up and trying to make sure it's a level play field across around the world?
Maybe to some degree, but I do think some of this is a bit different from that too. But yeah, from like Apple's point of view, when you're getting attacked from different angles for different reasons, at some point, it probably just makes sense to come out with a friendlier attitude towards some of this stuff and not fight tooth and nail about every detail. And of course, they'll fight a lot about much of this. But yeah, I do think there is parts to that, and not just with the EU, but even in Asia, there's been, like, I think some of the earliest regulatory actions, like against, I'm blanking on the term, but allowing links in the app that link outward to websites. I want to say it was like South Korea that was the first mover in forcing Apple to change its policies in that country. And then the EU followed that, and maybe the US will follow some of that. But yeah, I don't know how much of it is like countries catching up with each other as much as it is just like Apple actually has overreached on some of this, and everyone is coming to the same realizations in their own ways over time. I will say the EU probably goes too far in some of it, and the EU just has a tendency to fleece US companies with just like backwards looking like policies. Like they'll say, hey, we just determined this is now a law, but because you've been doing this for the past 5 years, we're going to fine you however many billions of dollars. And that's ridiculous. Like, that's absurd. Like, shame on the EU for doing things like that. I do think some of the pushing there will be helpful, and we'll see ripple effects in other jurisdictions.
I think the whole thing with the playing catch-up thing is interesting in the sense of thinking about the EU and these other countries proving that it doesn't kill Apple's business to do these things, even if they're going to very maliciously comply on some of them, that it's not the end of the world, and that there can be pushback on Apple to maybe play ball a little bit more, as you're saying, Aaron. Like, maybe they need to not just say, no, we don't want to do any of that. And I think the EU and some of these other territories become like an interesting playing field for that, because it's not the home territory. It's an area where they want to do business actively and need to like be like, okay, if we want to do business here, we have to actually maybe comply with some things and not just do whatever we want, because it's not your home turf anymore. And I think that happens a lot across these different territories, where if you want to play ball, you have to like actually think about, okay, it's a different ecosystem. I can't just say I'm the dominant thing here. You got to do it. Like, and I think that's an important lesson for Apple in general, because I wanted to push back a little bit on what you're saying about the ridiculousness, Aaron, and the culture of Apple, because I think a lot of that's actually more recent than you want to think, in terms of like a lot of it's more post Steve Jobs. So if you look back at when Apple was making its comeback into the iPod era and stuff like that, Apple was more than willing to play ball in a lot of ways to try and get its ground back, meaning like not closing its ecosystem, actually being a lot more open about it. There was iTunes for Windows, QuickTime for Windows. They were willing to accommodate all kinds of people to be like, hey, we want you to use our product, so we're going to go out of our way to make it so that you can do so, because we're not this elitist company. And how the tables have turned once that worked is the opposite of what they used to be. They're very much, they're an adapter company now, is what I like to put it, because they're more concerned with making everything their own proprietary standard now. And they used to be the opposite. They used to be very much about supporting standards, pushing that stuff forward. You remember when Safari was like, oh, it's cool, we'll support WebKit, we'll contribute back too. And it's like, good luck using anything but Safari on a lot of their stuff now, like for security reasons, supposedly. And they keep playing that security and privacy card to death, to the point where it's obvious that there are situations where it's not true anymore. So like the example you gave about allowing apps within app. It's, you've already sandboxed apps out from your apps, meaning like Apple's apps can already do more than the apps in there, which is part of what this suit's about. Clearly, you know how to sandbox things and restrict activity. There's no reason you can't do that for apps within apps. Like, and they already were like, they were trying to go that direction originally by being like, hey, it's cool, we like support HTML5, like progressive web apps and all this stuff. And then as soon as they felt like, all right, now we can close the door on that, they tried to, and then it had to backpedal on that in the EU. And I don't think Apple's totally malicious, but I think they're definitely at the point of looking out for their own far more than they are of looking out for meeting customers where they are. And I think that's where they just need to be checked a little. Maybe it is a little ridiculous at times, but I, like you mentioned the bubble thing, and I actually, as a Beeper user, witnessed a lot of that like back and forth battle over the standards of them, of Apple maliciously trying to lock out people from creating interoperability, where it's not like, hey, we're trying to steal your stuff. We're just trying to make so your customers can talk to other people without this being a huge hassle, and they're actively like practically DDoSing servers and stuff to just shut that down. So I think there's definitely situations where it sounds ridiculous to look at the details, and then there are situations, yeah, where it's probably a little bit of overreach, maybe a little bit of hyperbole to try and make this a bigger case. But at the same time, like, I think this is, it's, we need a sort of period similar to what happened with Microsoft, where they really got checked hard over Internet Explorer and those other things. And it, I don't think Microsoft's a saint now, but they did scale back a lot of that sort of behavior. And I think they're a much better citizen now, to the point where I'm actually a lot more pro-Microsoft than I would have been a decade or two ago, for sure. And they're a lot more about interoperability without being embraced and extend. And I think we just need to go through that same cycle with Apple. You get successful enough, maybe get a little greedy, get checked a bit, and then have to go, okay, let's find a compromise and not a malicious compromise. But we'll see. Like you said, this is going to take forever to shake out. And some of it's trickling back from these other countries. Some of it's just maybe people seeing what they can get away with in court against Apple because it's a big target right now. And that tends to happen a lot, as we've seen with the FTC, especially in the US. They like to try and pick big, they want to play these David versus Goliath kind of battles and try and come out ahead. That hasn't really actually been working great. So maybe this will not even be a big deal for Apple, just a big cost output for them. After the Epic battles, I think at this point, their lawyers are sitting fat and happy, just in terms of they're getting their work. But Apple is still having potentially future money issues with stuff like scaling back iPhones in China and things like that. It's not in a place where it's just like everything's peachy for them. And I do hope it forces like positive changes all. But,
it'll be fine. And honestly, like this topic is so boring at this point. Like I'm just so tired of talking about regulatory stuff and like all these details are like, we'll see. But what I do want to like double underline about this again is that this isn't about the App Store. This is about like now, like the anger has like toppled over into just like attacking what makes Apple special, which is like its vertical integration and like all the features and tool sets it has to make its own product better than others on the market. And I do think some of that is fair for them to like to have. If like you're building your own ecosystem, sure, make it so that it works best on your own products. That makes a lot of sense. I don't think that's necessarily bad. But yeah, we'll see where this all goes. But let's talk about something else, Devin, please.
Something much more cheery, but on the topic of mobile, which is some interesting information about potential for mobile spending to go down, which I think is to be expected.
Yes, Misplay, which is a loyalty platform inside the mobile space, has put together a report and has made it public that 32% of mobile consumers plan on spending less in 2024. So as reports available in general, they do have a number of takeaways inside there. Now, I will note that they are a loyalty platform, so there are some takeaways that are a little bit focused or skewed on that side to help push up why people should use Misplay. But definitely some interesting things that certainly affect everyone across the mobile ecosystem. Apparently, in addition to the 32% of mobile consumers in general, 41% of high-value spenders, which Misplay qualifies as people who spend $100 US per month on games, plan on decreasing their spend. So 41% of high spenders plan on decreasing their spend in 2024. And 3% of those planning on spending a lot less. So we're now looking at a situation where it's not just the people that spend a few dollars per month pulling back in terms of how much they're spending, but the individuals that a lot of games depend on, the so-called whales, dolphins, are the ones that are looking at pulling back their spends. They do offer some other insights based on this report. 32% will spend on a good offer. If you are able to put something together that does seem like it's a good deal, then people will go ahead, pull the trigger. Devin's shaking his head because, yeah, whatever.
This is the markup to mark down time, basically.
Yeah. 40% will spend on more personalized offers. So if it is something that's been put together for your progression inside the game or what your current moment-to-moment experience is like, you're more likely to get a spend. And they did note that social influence helps with your top of your funnel, so in terms of getting your installs, but not with the purchase side. So you're definitely going to get more people in if you're able to build that community out, but that community is not necessarily going to help with the spend. So I think looking at this, back to my earlier question of can we start tracking ad revenue if people are hopefully still planning on engaging inside these games, but maybe not spending as much, do companies need to now look even more at how do you increase their ad revenue inside the games to help offset some of those IP spends that they're going to be missing? Or is it just going to be in general, mobile's going to have a tough year and we're going to be looking at more companies that are going to have challenges, especially as you're dealing with UA challenges where you're trying to best acquire the spenders, they're going to be even that much more challenging to go up against the people that are able to spend a lot of money, acquire the best users, and ensure that those people are the ones that they're acquiring are the ones that are going to continue to spend.
Yeah, I didn't read the report, but I read some of the coverage of the report that you linked to, and I don't know if the coverage did a very good job of framing things well. Also, this survey, I think, where this data is coming from, it's just like 2,000 people, just US and Canada. I don't know how accurate it actually is, especially looking globally, but also, like, the headline was 32% of respondents said they would spend less on in-app purchases. Does that mean 68% are saying more or the same? I just thought the framing of that was weird. So maybe you could clarify that.
So they didn't go too much into whether or not that 68% would spend more. For me, the biggest point out of there is the 41% of high spenders spending less, and spend that there is almost 25% spending much less. As I look at what that means across the board, is probably people are going to focus on either fewer games that they're going to be putting their money into, or just decreasing the amount that they spend. So they did dive into looking at breaking out individual groups and taking some, you know, standardized characters. I think one of them, for example, was Lucky Lucy. You looked at social casino play. And they did break down how many games per month that they were playing. Was it how many people just played one? How many people played two or three? How many people played more? Where did they spend inside those? So there certainly was a little bit more detail on that level. But it was something that across the board in terms of each of the demographic groupings that they had, there certainly was an overall feeling that they were going to be spending less over the course of the year. I do think that 68% is more likely to maintain their spend rather than look at increasing their spend over that time. And there certainly was a lot, some takeaways that, hey, if you've got a loyalty program in place, then people are more likely to spend, especially if people are able to see a better end result, be it play inside of your games and you'll get a bit of a monetary return. My wife loves playing the games where you play match three, you're able to engage inside the game for a long period of time, and you start earning money that goes towards like an Amazon gift card. And I think those are the types of loyalty programs where they say they're seeing a lot more engagement, more likelihood to spend if you are going to then see a return on the other end. Some of it just, I think, makes common sense. Put together a good offer, make sure that's a personalized offer. People are more likely to spend on those types of things. I think that if the intent to reduce your spend is there, then for game companies, it's going to be focusing on how do I better optimize my stores, my offers? Do I look at different ways of getting people to spend their money? So offering games cross-platform, being able to get payment inside the games outside of the mobile versions, and hopefully get a better rate out of those ones instead of paying Apple's and Google's 30% DMetrics Solo and getting a better overall percentage of revenue from the spend. So I think mobile may be in for another tough year, and it's going to be a lot more of the people that really know how to optimize their stores, optimize their offers, put together really good live offerings that are really going to be able to be successful. Those that have a hard time understanding how to really run live operations and how to really look at optimizing, putting together really good offers, they're going to have a tougher time this year.
I got to laugh that starts off with impulse spenders planning to spend less. Of course they are. Yeah, of course. They're gonna do that budget next week. Don't worry. That being said, I do think there's a bit of truth to it, but it is funny to approach it from that way. I'm sure not all of them are impulse spenders, but I think if the takeaway is that, hey, the days of like very easy, lazy sales are over, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think like you should try and make better value, do a better job of selling to people when they want something and what they want. I don't think those are bad things. And I think this is like one of those kind of, yeah, if people have less money to throw around and are maybe doing a little bit less impulse spending, a little bit less loose with the wallet, that you should have to work for it a little bit more. And I think maybe we had some periods, especially during COVID, where it was a little too easy and everyone got used to that, a little too comfortable. Maybe this is an opportunity for AI to claim it has a product to personalize all the sales for you, things like that. But I'm certainly not against personalized sales being like, hey, here's what we think you want, and I actually want it, and I give you money, and then it sounds like a deal to me. I don't think this is a bad thing. It does mean, though, that people need to pay better attention, I think, to make sure they're making people happy with these, or happy enough to, like you said, loyalty programs. And the other thing is, I do think this will increase ads as a monetization source. I think that we've been trending that way for a while, especially with hybrid casual, normalizing, I think, a little bit more of ads into casual away from just the IAP spend. And I think a lessened dependency on whales for all of your finances, I think, is probably a good thing. If the whales start cutting back and you have to start looking at how we maybe going to get the free players to justify their presence a little bit better through watching some ads and things like that, or just maybe provide better value so that the whales are more willing to spend, I think those are healthy things for this ecosystem, and just it's the direction we'll have to go, which is fine. Like, just do a better job of it. But I do think it is going to mean a lot more ads, unfortunately. Which is a downside. I would love to say that Web3 would save this and be like, hey, now you've got value because you can resell your stuff and all that, but I don't think that's gonna
I hear a whole chorus of crypto bros. Web3.
I don't think that's gonna fly, but I do expect to hear a bit of that more in this situation. Like, that will be a play, I think, which is not without some merit, but I think might be a little
for a minority of games. Honestly, I don't know what to make of this. I do think some of the data is probably valid, but like, the whole other side of the spectrum here is just like, is targeting going to get easier or harder? And I honestly don't know like where we are in that trough. And I think there's big questions about what's going to happen to fingerprinting, et cetera. But I can imagine that in the future, as platforms like Facebook and TikTok, wherever, they get better at serving more personalized ads built on their own algorithms that are just better than they used to be and don't rely on IDFA type elements as much anymore. Like, you can start to target people better than you have been able to these past couple of years. And even if overall spending on average dips a bit, teams can still maybe get smarter again in targeting. I don't know enough about that ad tech landscape to comment super intelligently on that, but that's just what's been going through my mind as I've been hearing this discussion.
Yeah. I mean, I think the ad side of things, in terms of the surfacing of the ads, the bringing in of the players, I think, ideally, hopefully it does get better. I think where people are going to have trouble is, once the people are in, how do they best monetize them through the offerings, in terms of what IP they're putting forward at what point, how they integrate things like incentivized ads. I think there are a lot of companies out there, they'll just put, okay, we know there's a break point here, we'll just pop up an ad. But how do you actually bring in the incentivized ads so you can get additional revenue as compared to just the pop-ups? And then how do you convince the people that what is being offered at this particular moment is a great deal, and yes, I should get it right now, because it'll make my experience that much better. And I do think that there are companies that are really good at the sales side and making sure that's coming out at the right time. And I think they will continue to do okay. I think it's the people that treat live operations as, it's something that's like more of a checkbox. Yes, we have live operations. Yes, we've got an ad network built in. Yes, we have some IAP inside there. They're the ones that are going to have the biggest challenge overall.
Yeah, like I said, I think this is healthy for the industry in terms of like needing to rethink this stuff. And it will be interesting how the ad landscape shakes out, because I think if it is like way harder to acquire users, then you might have this sort of like ping pong effect where people drop out of doing it. And then suddenly that actually makes it less competitive, which actually might make it more affordable. And this kind of like back and forth. And I think in those landscapes where you have people that can afford to dive into it, they have an opportunity then to take over market share because if everyone's like, hey, this is too expensive now, we just can't compete anymore, we're not going to spend money on ads, instead we're going to try and receive money from ads and make the games more ad supported, and maybe we can try and turn around a little bit into some user acquisition, maybe try and find some other ways to acquire users that are more like through viral stuff that aren't paid ads and things like that. But and then the people who are willing to spend for all those ads to acquire users to the thing will take over that space because they have the money to do so. And so it's, I think, you have that sort of consolidation period, which is what we're seeing across tech, across games, across everything. Some of it further along than others, but I think it's a period where it doesn't go to zero. It just goes to the winner is whoever is still willing to spend at that point. And I think that is it can be good for those who are willing to shift some of their business models to making money from those ads and then not depending as much on the people scaling back. It kind of like sort of balances itself out, but in more of a sine wave thing. And it's just kind of like a period, a cyclical period thing, right? Where we see this all the time where you get these downturns and then like people take over market share, people consolidate, and then it goes back up again, right? Where it's sort of like a cleaning house of things. It's not great for everyone, but it's healthy and better when it can just happen and like actually adjust things. But as ad tech changes too, I think I like Aaron, I don't know enough about the current landscape to comment on that, but I think it's obvious that people are going to continue to try and push towards improving it because there's money in doing that. And I think as long as there's money doing it, at least in America, as long as there's money in doing it, people will be doing it, or at least trying to do it, right? And I think with all the pushes in machine learning and AI and things like that, there's obvious like technology that could be leveraged against it. We'll see if it works. I don't know if we get to Minority Report kind of level stuff where it's just everywhere you look, it's personalized ads at you, but it's certainly going to be the case where you could throw up walls all day long like IDFA, but people will find ways around it because they're literally monetarily incentivized to do so. It just won't be everyone finding ways to do it. And it, again, this is just, I think, shaking out the people, like Dave said, that are just checking a box as opposed to those that are a bit more dedicated to adapting, really. I feel bad for those who lose out swiftly.
There's an AI platform that'll solve all of that.
It's no fine, problem. Yeah. GPT-12 will take care of it, no problem. We'll see. But it's going to be an interesting period, I think. But I think a lot of opportunity for those who are willing to like just grunt through it to have some cool stuff on the other end, hopefully. And not hopefully not an ad dystopia. I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of ads, but I am a big fan of ads that are relevant to me. I don't want to watch ads that are pointless. So why not meet in the middle? Show me more ads, but show me more ads I want to see. And then everyone's happy, right? But hey, we'll see. Everyone's battling over that stuff right now. Obviously, like Apple especially is in a weird spot where they're in the Facebook position where they've clearly said, we don't really care so much about you guys' business anymore. And there's not necessarily a new one to move to. So landscape is kind of wide open to someone to kind of swoop in and do something really interesting. And maybe that's not even a new hardware platform. Maybe that is things like Roblox and UEFN to be like a platform within a platform. And maybe that's the next space in that. But anyways, this is a topic that I think could go on for some time in terms of both talking about and playing out over the next couple of years. Unfortunately, there won't be, at least for the near future, roundtables to discuss it, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't send us comments about it anyways to podcast@navik.co. And of course, we have all of our other interviews where we'll be discussing some of this stuff, I imagine, with industry people. That's certainly not slowing down. Lots of cool topics there. As Aaron mentioned, I am also engaging in some of those discussions with, I think, some pretty interesting people and some interesting topics that I think a bit modern and forward-looking stuff. We also, of course, have the digest stuff. It may not be like shotgunning you in the face as much as it was not too long ago. I think we've caught a better pace where maybe people could read all of it, and definitely a lot of cool, interesting topics going out there as well, and I think a good spread of those. But as Aaron said, we look forward to hopefully getting some feedback on what you guys want to see, because of course, like, that's who we're making it for. So let us know. And if you're just passionate about the roundtable, finding some format that works that you're going to drive a huge audience to, please reach out to us. I don't think
make your case. Let's hear it. Let's see what you want. Seriously, any weird, wacky ideas, I'm all for it.
I think Aaron's waiting for someone to beg for a game show.
I would love a game show. Please give me good ideas for game shows. I would love to find ways to make that work on the podcast. Yeah. Let's bring the fun. Let's do it.
You heard it here. Like, start plugging it. Get it going. At least prepare your arguments. But anyways, I want to thank everyone who's been here, especially those hitting 138 with us in terms of episodes. And Dave, while you may have only been a year, I think you packed it in. And when Aaron's talking about logistical,
I tried my best.
Dave was the man always waiting on the bench. And so a big thanks to Dave, Aaron as well, everyone who's stepped up, every panelist we've had, especially the ones that I've interacted with. Super appreciate everyone who's been involved. And I just want to say that out publicly to everyone, like, really awesome job. I think Navik does fantastic work and this is part of it. And a little bittersweet to see it go, but also moving forward to continued awesome stuff. It certainly hasn't ended or slowed down, just continues to change forms. So look forward to many more, hopefully, years of different forms of interactions and hotel lobbies. But in the meantime, wish everyone a great weekend, and I'd catch you guys in other forms from now on. But thank you, everyone.
If you enjoyed today's episode, whether on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, make sure to like, subscribe, comment, or give a 5-star review. And if you want to reach out or provide feedback, shoot us a note at podcast@navik.co or find us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Plus, if you want to learn more about what Navik has to offer, make sure to check out our website, www.navik.co. There, you can sign up for the #1 games industry newsletter, Navik Digest, or contact us to learn about our wide-ranging consulting and advisory services. Again, that is www.navik.co. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.